and I can't believe that I ever sounded like it. In those days, you only had letters. Anything you said would take about a week to come back to you. People like me were not getting the bites of the cherry anymore.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Colin Berry.
I had the crystal set, which I can't remember how I came by it. Obviously, my dad had got it for me and fixed it up. And that heavy sort of metal thing on your head in the bed, I don't know how I managed with it, but I did. And it was the start of listening to radio. I was probably about 9 or 10, something like that, I would think. We had a radiogram, a Ferguson radiogram, folks. A pride and joy for me, because by then I was probably getting on for about 11 or 12 years of age. And I was able to sort of fix it up with a speaker in the kitchen and broadcast to my parents. I don't think they liked it very much at the time. But I would tape records on family favourites and generally sort of link them in a pretty poor way at the time, I imagine. But that was the start, really, of my interest in being on the radio. I had quite a bad lisp when I was a child, and I managed to conquer it, worked very hard at it, and later on people at Radio Caroline who were broadcasters helped me and gave me a few tips, and that's what managed to get me across it. But that was very apparent when I was doing my stuff at home anyway. But no, that was it, really, just sitting there in front of an auto-changer record player and with the gaps and everything else, trying to get some kind of programme together. And as time went on, they got a little bit better, I have to say, but only purely because of enthusiasm.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the last time you'll ever hear that theme, and it's been played for many, many years. Music While You Work was played this morning by Jimmy Leach and his Organolians.
And I liked all sorts of very odd things, like Music While You Work, because I'm a great light music fan. I have been ever since I was a child. I hankered to get these pieces of music I heard on the radio that I was told by various companies, I'm afraid they're not available to the general public. If you're a member of the Cinematographer Society, we can arrange them for you. You couldn't get them for love nor money. I can remember trying to get the ITN News theme and also the Emergency Ward 10 theme. I think it was on a non-commercial disc, and I just conned my way to getting that. I went up with my 7 and 6 pence or whatever. So I seem to have 7 and 6 pence in my mind to get this 78 from Feldman's, and sort of blagging my way and saying that we're putting some sort of film together. And that's how I got it. I was never short of coming forward if I was desperate to get hold of a record. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. Well, I did, really, you know, but my dad said, oh, you know, forget all about that. You won't get into that sort of thing, you know. And so I didn't forget all about it. But he put me into one of his shops. He was a company director of a big conglomerate which involved things like Perk stores, Fine Fair or Premier supermarkets, I think, he was to do with. And he had a shop not far from where I was living with my mum and dad. And he said, look, go in there and just learn the trade. It'll do you no harm at all. So I was about to do that. And a next-door neighbour knocked at our door and said, is Colin still interested in getting into radio or television? And so my mum said, yeah. And I came out from the kitchen. I said, yeah, I am, actually. And this man was the manager of an Oxford Street store called Pemberthy's. And he used to have lunch with somebody down the road who worked at Granada TV. He apparently had a word with him and mentioned that I was interested in being in radio and television. He said, well, I've got a job here for somebody to slot commercials into commercial breaks, and tell him to come along and see me. So I went along to see this tiger of a man called Frank Smith. Huge guy, known as Tiny Smith for obvious reasons. And he was a real kind of sort of East Ender, sort of come North London guy. And he took me on. He was feared quite a lot, but I think he had a heart of gold, really, beneath that exterior. And there I was, slotting commercials into commercial breaks, which today, of course, is all done on computer. But in those days, you had these huge roller boards that you had to push up. I mean, you needed good, strong arms, I can tell you. And you would write the name of the commercial, Mars Bars, if you like, in the little gap, and you would put a coloured signal over it to show what kind of a booking it was with the advertising agencies. So I did that for a while. Got a bit bored with that, and my arms were beginning to ache, and I saw there was a job going at the now defunct Westwood Television, doing the similar thing, but also selling time. Big mistake. I went there and absolutely hated it. But what actually happened then was I had a phone call from somebody I knew at Granada when I was working there, and he said to me, are you happy? I said, well, funny you should ring today. No, I'm not. And he said, well, there's something that might interest you. He said, I'm running the advertising department at Radio Caroline. And he said, you'll have read... I said, yes, I've read all about that, all over Easter and this, that and the other. And he said, well, I just wondered, I need an assistant here. Would you fancy it? I said, I think I really would. I went home and I talked to my dad. I thought, my dad's going to poo-poo it again. He said, no, you don't want to bother with all that. And he didn't. He said, you're keen enough. He said, give it a go. He said, you're young enough. And you won't be happy till you do, will you?
You're tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
So I went to Caroline and, again, slotting commercials, but doing a bit more than that. Drawing up manifests for things that had to go out to the ship, records, commercials, new commercials. I was based at 6 Chesterfield Gardens off Curzon Street, an absolute mansion that Ronan O'Reilly and his compatriots had acquired. And we were down in the basement, which was pretty awful. I mean, health and safety and efficiency and all that out the window, definitely, because it was a dreadful place with all raffia mats on the floor that you could break your neck on if you weren't careful. And it was cold down there as well, and not really clean. We didn't have office cleaners. So it was pretty ropey, I think is the expression. So we were down there, and along the corridor was the dubbing suite, where all the commercials were recorded. A voiceover man might come in and do one or two, and they would have to dub them onto a reel-to-reel to go out to the ship, because that's how they were done.
One is for you.
Four kinds of Sunsilk shampoo, because there are four kinds of hair. What's your hair type?
And of course, we often had late bookings on commercials, and I couldn't possibly tell you how they were done, shipped ashore and this, that, and the other, which was terribly illegal at the time, but I think we can talk about that now. A tame man down in Frinton-on-Sea at a certain time of night would speak to the ship and read out a commercial that had to go out the next day. So all that was done. We looked after all that kind of thing, and I was known as the assistant traffic manager. So really, I just kept on sort of doing little auditions and this, that and the other. And I'd heard that somebody was unwell out on the ship, and I spoke to Ken Evans, who was my program director there, and of course I've worked with him many times since at Radio 2. And he said, well, go in the studio, and I did a little bit, and he wasn't all that impressed with it, and I'm not surprised that he wasn't. But he said, I'll tell you what, go out to the ship, compile the news, and if the senior DJ at the time out there thinks you're good enough, you can do a bit on the air. So out I went to the ship when he wasn't well. Rough seas, that's what really hampered me. I couldn't take the rough seas. I think if you're moving on a ship, it's okay, but if you're just sitting there rolling at the mercy of the waves coming at you either side, you never quite cope with it. And I was pretty unwell. And it is true to say that it spoilt my chances in the future out there, because I did get asked to go out there a few times. I went out there about, I can't tell you how many times, it may only have been 3 or 4 times in terms of being out there for a few days. And I did have one stint out there where it was absolutely glorious and you could sunbathe on the top deck. But no, generally speaking, I felt pretty unwell out there. But I did do the compiling of the news first of all, on my first trip out there, and you just put on the BBC Light programme and you copy it down. Or you record it, and you actually record it onto a reel-to-reel first. And you just go through and pause it, and a bit more, then pause it, and then make notes.
This is the BBC Light programme. Here is the news. The people of Belgium beset by strikes...
Changing the odd word just to try and make it sound a bit different from the BBC. Then all of a sudden, I think it was a guy called Brian Vaughan, who was one of the DJs, and he was a senior DJ out there. He said, I think, Colin, you could go ahead and read it. So I did that.
From the international, national, regional, and local scene. Views on the hour, every hour, over 199 Radio Caroline.
Robin Berry reporting.
Good afternoon. The floods. Conditions in the flooded parts of England and Wales are said to be greatly improved, but the water is still rising along part of the Severn Valley. And at Worcester, the water has been rising at the rate of more than an inch an hour, and it's understood that if it rises another 4 inches, the situation could be serious. In Shrewsbury, the water level has dropped, but a few...
It was a terrifying moment, to be perfectly honest. In fact, when I listen to that recording, I'm surprised I don't sound more nervous. Because I feel it sounded quite authoritative, you know. The quality was pretty awful. There was a lot of engine noise in the background, which of course we had in those early days of Caroline. When I was known as Robin Berry originally when I went out there, basically because a dear friend of mine called Colin Nicol, who'd been on Radio Caroline for a while, got a bit of prima donna-ish about having two Collins on the ship. I mean, today you wouldn't turn a hair about it, but and it was getting near to Christmas, and so they said it'd be rather good to be Robin Berry. So that's why I was Robin Berry for the very first time out on the ship.
The next news on Caroline at 2 o'clock.
But I was back to the office and back to doing what I had to do on a general basis, but I didn't miss a chance. If there was an audition going, I would submit, and I did some sponsored programmes, which was great because I could do them in Caroline House and they'd be sent out to the ship. I didn't have to go and be seasick.
Enver Cream, the queen of Cyprus sherries.
So I did Enver Cream, Cyprus sherry, and then the one I did that I remember most of all is Weetabix Partners in Profit, which was a proof of purchase game that we did at the weekends, which was put on the air really to go hand in glove with Bill Hearn, who used to do Caroline Cash Casino during the week. So it was all, as I say, pre-recorded and sent out to the ship.
It's time for Partners in Profit.
Well, hello everyone, this is Colin Berry, and unfortunately, due to circumstances completely beyond our control, we're unable to pull out any letters on this particular segment of Partners in Profit.
No records put in. All I would say is, we'll be right back after this hit from the Caroline Countdown of Sound. And that would be up to the DJ to put whatever record he was going to play next. It was difficult, really, because you were at the mercy of how strong the signal was at the time. I lived in the Harrow area. Sometimes it was a very poor signal and you'd really struggle to try and, you know, listen to it for a while. Other days it would be really strong. We knew that at best you were covering sort of Norfolk, Suffolk, Lincolnshire, Cambridgeshire and getting into London. But as time went on, I think they boosted it and it was covering a good bit of the southeast of England, yeah.
Yes, the battle is on, and as part of it, Broadside's free radio fighters are building up the greatest ever petition on behalf of free radio in Britain. Through this petition, the nation can raise its voice to protest the government's action in steamrolling legislation against the wishes of 25 million
Britons. Yes, it was the Labour government's ending of the pirate stations. Marine Offences Bill came into force on the 14th of August 1967, and I was going to be out of work, virtually. I was offered the chance to go out to the ship to read the news and possibly to do some fill-in programmes along with Robbie Dale and Johnny Walker. And it was the hardest thing for me to say no, but it wasn't quite so hard when I knew that the tender would be hours and hours and hours getting out to the ship because it had to come from Holland. You had to get yourself out to Holland and it was a long, long journey. And since I heard people like Johnny and I think Robbie Dale had both had some pretty bad crossings, were quite ill, having been quite robust getting across from Harwich and Felixstowe, no problem at all. So I was very glad I did say no. But we came to a kind of a compromise and they said, well, we'd like you to run some of our disc nights, which is what they were called in those days, very straightforward. And they were all over the place. I think the Chislehurst Caves had one, a place called the Bal Tambourine down in southeast London, Starlight Ballroom Greenford, and one or two others as well. So I used to go up on the stage stage and do my bit and introduce Radio London DJs and Caroline DJs. Obviously, they weren't any more, but they were still popular and still around. And I think I did a bit of that actually while Caroline was on the air, which is why, obviously, I was offered the chance to do it. They knew I could do it.
It gives me great pleasure to initiate this first broadcast from Yorkshire Television's new studios in Leeds.
It's not documented in many places because it was a terrible time and I was treated very badly. Again, my dear friend Arthur, who is no longer with us sadly, who rang me when I was at Westwood Television in the London office and said, would you like to come and join us at Radio Caroline? He rang me again and said, you know, I'm sorry to hear it's all come to an end for you. He was somewhere else now working for ITV, I think Grampian Television, doing the sales side of things. And he said to me, I'm sorry if it's all come to an end for you. Have you got anything lined up? I said, well, nothing really at the moment. And he said, well, Yorkshire Television is going to go on the air in about a year's time. And he said, there's somebody who needs an assistant there. And they are in Portland Place, opposite the BBC. So I thought, I don't really want to do this again, but I need some money. So I went and had a chat, and it was an empty shell of a building, and they hadn't got any staff at all. Anyway, kind of long story short, and a rather boring one, and one I prefer not to remember. I did join them until they went on the air. I went on holiday, aware that they were taking people in from all different ITV companies. Well, I came back from holiday, and I was stopped at reception and told, would I wait to see the sales director? I was still a bit wet behind the ears in those days, I have to say, and today you would treat it differently. Today you'd be treated differently too, you'd go to a tribunal. I was not allowed to go upstairs, but I was told that I made a lot of mistakes with something or other, and I said, please let me see, and they wouldn't let me go upstairs. And long and short of it, they paid me off, and I walked out totally stunned. And of course, added to that, I kept in touch with some colleagues there, and I found out that they were not aware of anything that had gone wrong at all. But no, that was a horrible time. I very rarely document that I spent any time at Yorkshire Television because I always felt they wanted to get people in that they knew. They didn't know the measure of me because I've been with Caroline and places like that, you see. And my dim and distant past was Granada and Westwood. And they wanted to get fresher people in, but, you know, what a way to do it. Let you go on holiday, come back, and they say, sorry, there's been a lot of problems up there, and but pay me off reasonably well. So, after that, I'd already got to know quite a few people at the BBC through the pirate people who were around and introduced me to people at the BBC who they'd begun to work with, and I'd become very friendly with a guy called Roger Moffat.
Well, there we end broadcasting in the Light programme, not just for today, but, as it seems, forever. The Light programme, that is, as it's known now, is closing down.
Roger said to me when he saw me come in one day after this had happened at Yorkshire Television, he said, have a drink. Well, he would, wouldn't he? If he liked anything, he liked a drink, did Roger, bless him, and I miss him today. And Roger said to me one day after I had weeks of walking around and not really sort of having a job, said, how would you like to be a record plugger? I thought, oh, I've been on the other end of those, and how could I do that? And I thought, well, I could give it a go. So he said, well, there's a company, Campbell Canelli, that could do with one. So cut a long story short here. The first day I worked for them, I came into the George, and I came up to Roger, and I said, Roger, I got the job. He said, I don't speak to pluggers. That's a great famous story, that. I did it for a while, actually, whilst I was also doing some local radio. I managed to get chatting to one of the producers when I was plugging him with a record, and he was going to go to open up Radio Medway, as it was then, now BBC Radio Kent, and they offered me some programmes down there. I ended up doing their Saturday afternoon music and sports show. Again, nice having an expense account. It wasn't a very good expense account. It was ridiculous, quite honestly, but I managed to make it work. Took a lot of people out to lunch that I knew could help me with my record plugging, but I also knew might better help me with me, if you get my drift. And there was a guy, a veritable tiger of a man that I always got on well with, but it could be quite frightening, called Jimmy Kingsbury. And he was head of presentation for Radio 2, of Radio 1 and Radio 2, as they were combined in those days. And I'd taken him to lunch and a few times and chatted to him. Sometime afterwards, he rang me up at the Campbell Canelli office and said, Tony Myatt is leaving me and going to Capital Radio to start up there, as are a lot of people going to LBC and I think BRMB. That was about it, I think, in those days. And he said, would you like a job, mate? I said, I'd love a job, Jimmy. Well, what are you thinking of? He said, well, Tony Myatt's job. He said, he runs the what we used to call the trailer unit, program promotions trailer unit, for Radio 1 and Radio 2. You would be voicing them. We would buy in another person. It might be Ann Nightingale, it might be Steve Jones. That would be the way it would run. And you would do Night Ride on a Friday night between midnight and 2 a.m. He was a damn good teacher. And he did this with James Alexander Gordon. He had this attitude that he thought it was very good to let you make your mistakes on the air with the baptism of fire. And he did that with James and myself, because I was, you know, I was quite out of touch with doing radio on a regular basis. I did the odd programme for Radio Medway, as it was, but I'd done nothing on a regular basis, on a daily basis. And he did. He let us. And, you know, I did make my mistakes, some quite appalling ones, some, you know, when I look back. So I went and started there on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday would be me doing the trails and recording them or writing them or you know, just getting them together. Hard work, really, but I enjoyed it. It was a good baptism of fire for me. And dear old Jimmy, if someone was on holiday, he'd often put himself in to do a show, which was a bit naughty, really, when there were plenty of other people on the staff there in presentation that would have given their, you know, eye teeth to have done it. But Jimmy would do it, you see. And anyway, Jimmy rang in on the Wednesday, said, Colin, could you do a Night Ride tonight? I've gone sick. And I thought about another couple of days before I did that. So my very first week, I did his Night Ride on the Wednesday and my own on the Friday. Again, very nervous, and you had to read your own news as well at the time. But it was fine, and we got through that. I eventually said to Jimmy, I don't think it's good for you or good for me to have me as a voice on so many trails and for me writing the same old trails. You know, what can I say about Friday night is music night that I haven't said 10 times before? And he said, I think you're right, mate. He said, we'll get you onto the general rota. So one day I might be down at the Paris studios doing a top and tail for a comedy show, or I might be doing a programme, if I had a programme at the time, or reading the news. Or doing continuity, because you had a newsreader and a continuity announcer in those days. They've learnt to be more economic about that these days, of course. It was quite a patchwork quilt, the rota, and you never got bored because you were, you know, always doing different things through your five-day week. So that was it, and then I got picked to do all sorts of programmes, depping for Jimmy Young, depping for Terry Wogan, depping for David Hamilton, John Dunn, and quite a few other people, and getting my own shows, including the late night ones that I was doing anyway, doing a lot of early breakfast shows, which I really enjoyed doing. And of course, while I was doing that, I wasn't doing the news. But I actually asked to do the news because I feel it's a very important thing. You've always got to come back to that at some time, and you can get into very bad habits and out of practice of reading news. And I think they used to think I was mad, but I used to say, can I have a shift as well as doing that? Just do a half-day shift or something. And, oh, yeah, great, you know, we can deploy someone else somewhere else. Sort of, you know, we can redo the rota and have more people to spare. But as I say, I always kept my hand in with the news reading, which I think is what spurred Radio Magazine, now defunct, or long time defunct now, who actually asked, is Colin Berry the longest continuous serving newsreader on radio? If you know differently, let us know. And nobody did. And I think the only one that got near to it was Peter Donaldson, but he broke his time with the BBC to go to Radio Hallam for about 6 months. The only other one would have been Brian Perkins. He went back to New Zealand for a few years. So nobody could find anybody who had been reading the news right through from, well, in my case, 1973 to whatever date that was in the early 2000s, I think it was.
We join Colin Berry in the Radio 2 newsroom.
More prolonged outbreaks of sleet and snow now over central and eastern areas of England will slowly die out from the northwest.
Remember school days, subject and predicate. If you can remember that, you can't go wrong. I can't bear hearing people who have this parrot fashion and don't really understand what they're reading. I'm not going to say that's never happened to me, because if you get it put in front of you too late, you have to do your best. There's even a knack with that, I think, you know, which you can almost see the pitfalls coming up. Without doing equal stress, I think you can actually, you can mould it, which you can only do really with experience, I think. It's who said what to whom and about what. And if you can just remember that, which is what you were probably taught in the latter days of your primary school, I don't think you can go far wrong, really.
I will have Newsbeat on Radio 1 at 5:30.
Radio 1 was great fun because you'd often get into a little chat with Tony Blackburn or whoever was doing the programme at the time, and they didn't mind that. Radio 2 was always kept pretty straight in those sort of early to mid years for me. Yeah, I would always punch it a bit harder on Radio 1. Not all my colleagues would do that, their choice, but I just felt that it needed a punchier sort of style. Yeah.
Colin Berry.
3 minutes past six, and it's good to have you awake bright and early for the Friday programme. An hour of good music, dedications, and everything else you need to ensure a happy, helpful start to the day.
We were in the cutbacks, and I can't remember what they were all caused by, because there were various cutbacks, and we've got to close down early, we were on the air at 6 a.m. rather than 5 in about 76, I think it would have been. I only had an hour, 6 till 7 in those days. Terry would start at 7 o'clock, and Noel would start at 7 o'clock. But I would love to have looked at the figures. I don't think I ever saw the figures, but they must have been huge, I think, at 6:30. Local radio would opt out at 6:30.
Well, that's all from me for today on Radio Humberside. Hope you'll be with me again tomorrow at 6.
But I think they must have been really huge at that time in the morning. When you think so few commercial stations, as I said, BRMB was one I couldn't remember was on at the time. I can't remember the others. Of course, in those days, you only had letters. Anything you said would take about a week or 10 days to come back to you. So, I mean, they don't... I'll tell you what, broadcasters today don't know how they've got it made with all the, text messages and emails. It really has made a heck of a lot of difference. And I'm glad I've still been in the business to appreciate that, even when I was at Radio 2 and we had email, which was great. But I do look back and wonder how we did cope without having those instant responses.
34 years married today are Mr. and Mrs. Endersby of Attleborough in Norfolk. Neil Dix of Newport Pagnell, love comes to you from your mum on this your 15th birthday. Barbara Balls of Great Yarmouth.
The thing is, with certain programmes, I mean, Night Ride, it had some needle time, but quite honestly, not a lot. Well, needle time was the agreement with the musicians' union. Because I wasn't really terribly involved in all that, I don't really know the full story, but you're only allowed to play so much in the hour. I don't know why the Musicians' Union had such a hold over all this. Obviously, it was to help to keep them in business. It was mainly studio sessions, Henry McKenzie Quintet, the BBC Radio Orchestra, things like that, to fill it up, and foreign recordings. I think there was this organisation called Mozart Edition, CZAC, Voice of America, and you had another little cheeky one where you could play a commercial release if it was featured on the soundtrack of a film. You were supposed to play the soundtrack. How the heck you got hold of the soundtrack, the actual tapes of the soundtrack. But of course they didn't. They played the disc and said, just keep quiet about it. So that did help to boost the output of what were commercial discs, you know. That got a lot better, of course. But it got worse before it got better, because I was the first person to do Through the Night Radio in January, I think it was 1979.
Something of an historic night for BBC Radio. The close down in just a few moments' time will be the last on Radio 2. When the network opens up again at 5 o'clock, it's not due to close down again. And 24-hour broadcasting means that Radio News will, for the first time, be able to offer full round-the-clock coverage.
And in that four-hour show, I had 7 minutes needle time. So that was two tracks, one to open with, you know, Sprat to Catch the Mackerel, and another one strategically placed about halfway through.
It's on Saturday night, Sunday morning, when I'm presenting the first of our regular Through the Night programmes. I'll be with you from 2 until 6, so if you can make it, I'll be more than glad. The title of the programme, You and the Night and the Music, and you're a very important ingredient. From me to
spin-offs, you. Well, I did a generation game where they tried to get the voice to match the face and all this kind of thing, and I did, what else did I do? Blankety-blank, supermarket sweep. I was with Tony Blackman, my good lifelong friend, and we had to... just rush around and collect the clues, and I was dreadful. That's the worst television I ever did. I didn't do that much, but I mean, but Tony did rather well. He saved. I don't know whether we won it. I don't think we won it, but I think we came better than we would have done if it had been just left to me. Eurovision played a big part in my career, and that all came about really because my good friend, the late Ray Moore, a lovely guy, best man at my wedding and godfather, along with his wife, to my daughter Marina, he had been doing the job of giving the votes of the United Kingdom jury and also the London jury for the Song for Europe, because they were regional juries as well. He'd been doing that for a while. And all of a sudden, Radio 2, in their wisdom, decided they should be covering it. They hadn't covered it before, and they said they'd like Ray to do the commentary. So Ray said to me, if I put your name forward, would you be interested in doing my old job? So he spoke to a guy called Tony James, who was light entertainment organiser at the television centre. Has come along, have a chat. Yep, so I got it. Thought I'd probably do it for 2, maybe 3 years if I'm lucky, but I ended up doing it for 25 years. Officially, the EBU wanted you to stick to the usual thing. Good evening, this is London calling, here are the votes. You know, terribly boring. But of course, you'd always get a few of them who want to build up the part. And that started to happen and crept every year. So we all decided to do a little bit more and say something about what a wonderful show you've been doing tonight. Congratulations or something like that, you know. But always, every time I was warned, don't overdo it. Don't do as Finland or Switzerland do occasionally and go on chatting for a long time, particularly if you've got a delay, because that gets terribly awkward. And then all of a sudden they were going to change it. But for a lot of that time, it was just a voiceover job with a lip mic. But once we got into the 1990s, because we had the technology, as they say, they were able to put us all in vision, which was quite fun sometimes. Not fun once with Jerusalem, where there was not just the usual 3-second delay, it was about 5 or 6 seconds delay. They'd also left Terry Wogan's commentary, where he's very rude about me, in my ear feed. And I don't quite know how I got through that, but I did without actually either cracking up or falling over my words, but very difficult. I always remember that year.
United Kingdom, good evening, London. Good evening, Colin Berry.
Hello, Carrie, and a very good evening to all of you over there in Dublin. Is it time to go home, I ask myself?
Anyway, I don't think you'll be going anywhere, Colin, this evening. Certainly not home.
We won't count our chickens. I have here the results from the United Kingdom and for the...
But I did that, as I say, for 25 years, and then they wanted to make changes, but it was ironic that it was the year that I celebrated my 25 years, so they decided to have a little lunch for me, present me with a bronze microphone, the typical one that gets handed out to lots of people over the years. And Terry Wogan came along, and Ken Bruce, and which was lovely because, you know, it's only down the road in Great Portland Street, and they didn't have to come along. I mean, a lot of people made excuses. But lovely old Terry got up and he said, I want to say one thing. He said, if it ain't broke, why mend it? He said, why are you getting rid of your man? And of course, there was stony silence. Everyone felt a bit embarrassed, but Terry didn't care, you know, because he couldn't see why they were changing it. And the thing that cheers me most of all here is that ever since I did my last one, which I can't remember when it was now, but early 2000s, Ever since I did that, it's never settled down to anything. It's been somebody on a street corner, somebody in a studio, somebody on a roof somewhere, you know, could be somebody famous, somebody in a pop group. They've never settled down to one person doing it. So I think, well, you know, at least it was me for 25 years. Ray was ahead of his time because he was as sharp as he was towards the end of his time, even way back when he was doing things like Breakfast Special, which would have been in the late 1960s, had this inventive mind.
With such legendary names at this time of the morning as John Dunn, Paul Hollingworth, Peter Lavin, and a little boy called Raymond Moore.
He invented... Sorry, Terry, I'm going to tell this one. He invented the concrete donut, which was the television centre, BBC Television Centre, and you've only got to see it to know why he gave it the name. And then Terry used it all the time and reckoned he had. But it was Ray's phrase, "I'm down at the concrete donut tonight," because he'd go down there to do some shouting, as we said in the industries, you know, to do a few voiceovers for television trails. But he was well ahead, and one could say often looked over, although he did get pretty well all the debts for Terry, which was great. I got a few.
It's 20 years this weekend since BBC Radio lost one of its best loved broadcasters, Ray Moore. He was a good friend of mine, best man at our wedding, at Sandra and myself, and godfather to my daughter Marina. I promised you towards the end of last year that we would pay tribute to Ray, and we will do that now in the form...
The tribute programme actually was ready because we knew that he wasn't going to last very long, poor chap. And that was done by Ken Bruce. The hardest thing there for me was getting a phone call one day when I was going over to meet Ray at home. It was the last time I saw him, and it was Dennis O'Keefe. And Dennis said, "I'm going to have to ask you to do something you're not going to like doing." He said, "We've got to get an obituary together. Could you just go into Broadcasting House and do a couple of lines? You know, they'll know you're coming in." I said, "Well, as it happens, I'm going into London tonight." I said, "And I'm going over to see Ray." And he really was quite poorly by then. So I did that, and that was awful. I just felt numb after that. So that was the tribute programme. The programme that I was heavily involved in was the service at All Souls Church, which was sometime afterwards, I think, because that was... You know, everybody with Michael Aspel, I mean, all the DJs, anyone who was anybody was there. And obviously I worked out what I was going to say. I got to a point of reading out something and I turned over two pages. And I'd hardly opened my mouth and I realised that had happened. And I kind of made some comment. I can't remember what I said, but sort of implying that Ray would do this, wouldn't he, or something like that, you know. And I can remember Adrian Love saying to me when I got over to the BBC, the Governor's dining room afterwards, where we all went, he said, "You covered that really well." And when a colleague says it to you, it's nice, because if you didn't, they'd say nothing, you know, or tell you about it. But it was a moment that stayed with me for a while, because you know, don't want that to happen. But that was quite a high profile one. That you had the Sid Lawrence band in there playing as well. Terry spoke, I think, either before or after me. I can't remember which. And it was a lovely service. Yeah.
Spasibo, Pete Murrisky's Open House, or put another way, Morning All, thanks to Pete Murray for Open House, and welcome to the Jimmy Young programme, which, as Pete just said, is coming to you live from Moscow, capital of the Soviet Union. Now, during the next 2 days, we'll be taking...
Jimmy Young show stretched me in a way I'd never been stretched before. Only trouble was, the researchers on the Jimmy Young show were so used to JY that they used to write in his lingo. So it was... If you like another way of putting it, it was all written, all the little bits, lead-ins, were written in JYEs. So you would say, "You see, I mean..." and I had to go subbing everything out before I actually did it, you know. But I interviewed quite a few famous people. I think Joan Collins was one of the guests I had to talk to. But I've never thought I'm a very good interviewer, I have to say. If it's my weakest link, I think. I'm not good on genning up on research and that. I always say I'm a music man. I love my music. I'll always make the effort to gen up on anything to do with music, as long as it's something I enjoy. There's certain things I don't enjoy all that much. But I'm not happy sitting there interviewing guests that come in if I don't know much about them. And I admire people who do. Dear John Donne was fantastic. Fantastic guy. You know, how much time to research would he have 5 days a week? And he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. This is Radio 2. It was lovely. It was absolutely wonderful. It was a very happy atmosphere. I wouldn't say we never moaned about things, because it's an occupational sort of has to moan about your job, really, and whatever you're doing. But everybody was very happy and pleasant. You know, you'd see everybody up and down the corridors, be they Jimmy Young, Noel Edmonds, Simon Bates, anybody. Joyce, the tea lady, was down the end there with her teas and coffees, and she was always ready for a good laugh. It was a very happy atmosphere. I thoroughly enjoyed the 1970s into the early 1980s, really. It took great times, really were.
2 minutes past 10, and you're with Radio 2, in tune with you on 693 and 909 kilohertz, and in stereo on VHF.
Welcome to European Pop Jury.
Quite enjoyed European Pop Jury, because that was quite challenging. I'm stuck there in front of a studio audience, linking to different stations around Europe.
Hello once again, this is Colin Berry in a freezing cold London, following...
1 year, we had to do it from Brussels, because we had a post office strike here. 1 week, and then the next month it hadn't been resolved, because it was a monthly programme. Next month it hadn't been resolved, and I had to fly over to Brussels for a second occasion. The thing was, you see, we were the hosts of European Pop Jury, so if we couldn't do it, you know, it was egg on FaceTime, so we'd be in the BBC, we had to get this right. So they sent me over there to do it, and that was great fun, actually.
And a very good morning to you, wherever you're listening this Saturday morning, Saturday the 1st of April. Radio 2 coming your way on VHF, 247 and 1500 metres long wave, not forgetting those of you in tune with your BBC local radio stations.
The early breakfast shows I enjoyed doing very much, because, you know, people are getting up and they're not feeling their best, and it's just a nice time. I actually like those early mornings. I had the most frightening morning, my closest brush with death, I would say, the storm of October 1987.
Earlier on today, apparently, a woman rang the BBC and said she heard that there was a hurricane on the way. Well, if you're watching, don't worry, there isn't.
In those days, I had the luxury of having a BBC car take me in, 3:15 in the morning, and it would pick me up regularly. Very rarely was it late. And I got up this morning, I was aware of this sort of noise and the windows and the howling gale. I got down, opened the front door, could barely open the front door. He was out there waiting for me. He said, I thought I'd come up your drive just to make sure you're okay. We'll get there, don't worry. I said, God, this is awful, isn't it? He said, well, there are trees down and this, that and the other. He said, well, we'll get there. So we got in the car, and we drove from Hertfordshire up towards North London and sort of Brent Cross area, dodging all these trees and branches that were lying around. We got to Swiss Cottage, and there's a road that links Swiss Cottage with the Regent's Park called Avenue Road. And as we went down there, there were trees everywhere, but he was going on the pavement to avoid them and going over a few branches. We got almost to the park, and all of a sudden you'd heard this massive creak and crash down behind us, and literally it was probably only 50, 60 feet. A massive oak tree had gone right across the road if we had just been seconds later. That really kind of shook me up a bit. We got there, and of course it was one of those programmes where you played a record, a bit more travel news, another record, a bit more travel news, and it was really bad. South of England took the brunt of it. Then I think Ray came in afterwards, and he'd had a pretty bad time getting in, but he got in on time.
And it's 20 and a half minutes past eight, and there are no trains here in, well, it's the tubes, but in Britain there's a rail driver's strike, so Terry Wogan has decided to come to work the long way round, and he's flown on Concorde to Singapore. He should be on the line now from Bahrain. Good morning, Terry.
Hey, good morning, Colin.
Nice to talk to you. Are you still banjaxed by the snow and ice there?
We are, and expecting some more.
Terry Wogan, bless him, said to me years ago, Carl, you should go freelance. There's plenty of work for you out there. I said, Terry, it took me long enough to get my foot in the door. And I said, when I say get my foot in the door, I said, I always wanted to read the news. If you were freelance, you couldn't read the news. There was no way that you were allowed to read the news if you were freelance. And I loved the rota whereby you had a little bit of everything, as I said earlier, going down to the Paris studios or the Playhouse Theatre, doing a top and tail on the comedy show or the news headlines or something like that, where you met the public. You know, doing a few things maybe from the Golders Green Hippodrome music show, as I've done. Doing bits of everything and having a rota where you say, I'll never get bored with this. I wasn't worried about being freelance. I'm very much, I don't know whether Aquarians are normally like this. I think they are from what I was once told, but they work better under security. And I was doing what I wanted to do, quite honestly. I've seen enough people have months out. Even Ray had some months when he wasn't doing a daily show. He'd say, Carl, I think you're doing the right thing. He said, it's very lean at the moment, the next 6 weeks for me. So I thought, well, you know, if it's lean for him, what's it going to be like for me, you know? So no, I never really wanted to go freelance. I'm freelance now, in as much as the BBC have retired me. And I stayed on for a while as a freelance from 2006 to 2012. Now, as I say, I'm just doing what I want, what I'm asked to do, at my pace, and quite happy.
Goodbye, England's rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You were the grace, the place to say.
Well, I was staying overnight in the hotel that they used because they hadn't got the Langham anymore. And I'd got up, I thought, OK, I've got time to get over to do the 6 o'clock news, and I'm having a shave, and I'll put the telly on. What else is on? Not a lot. Sky, that time of the morning in whatever year it was, 1997, was it? I think it was. Anyway, I saw this ticker tape going along the bottom of the screen there. I just shaved and I went out into the main part of the room and it said, Diana and Dodie fired in car crashes. I thought, oh my goodness me. So I thought, what am I doing here? Forget the shaving, got dressed, rushed over to Broadcasting House, up to the little cell that we used to have as our news reading Studio 3F, as it was. Walked in there, there's the controller of Radio 2, the head of Radio 2, Alan Dedicote, who was the in charge of the announcers, all sitting around in this little studio. And I thought, you don't need me. And of course they didn't, because the practice in those days, and is still today, as far as I know, is that you get a major situation like that involving a death, and Diana was, I think there were rumours by then that she had died, you have a sustaining service of Radio 4 that carries on until it's decided that stations can go their separate ways.
This is BBC Radio News from London.
And I had nothing to do until 9 o'clock. But of course, Sunday morning, 9 o'clock is very much a switch-on point, and you're so aware that you are probably the first voice to tell that awful news. And I read a 12-minute bulletin that morning with hardly any, I don't think there was any actuality put in there at all, a few bits and pieces, because there wasn't a lot to have. And I think they rejigged the programme. Steve Wright's Sunday Love Songs was due in on that spot. Don McLean was doing the Good Morning Sunday God slot, as he used to call it, and he'd been moved to after me at 12 minutes past nine, and so that was that. And I then went home absolutely shattered. But I hadn't done anything, really. I'd read two news bulletins. I'd read the 10 o'clock as well. You know, the thought that you're the first voice that's probably told them this. They've just come out of their overnight lie-in, 9 o'clock in the morning. That was a hard one. It was.
This has been Huey After Midnight. I'm Huey Morgan, and this is BBC Radio 2. Online, on digital radio, and on 88 to 91 FM. Until next time, stay classy.
BBC News at 3 o'clock. This is Colin Berry. The focus of a French investigation into the murder of a British...
Damn squib, because it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And I even made a comment at the end of it. And that's all from me. And the next news at 4 o'clock. And I don't think Richard Allison, bless him, is a lovely bloke. I don't think he realised quite the significance of me saying that. And he made some comment that really meant he didn't understand what I meant, you know. And I thought, ah, you know, c'est la vie.
Whatever happened to equality? And that is likely to be it from me. BBC News at 3 minutes past three. Our next at four.
Colin, you obviously charge far too much.
We had been told that that would be the last one because they'd changed everything. What had been fought for years and years and years, and that is journalists reading the news, they had fought it fiercely and wouldn't allow it. They'd just let it slip through their fingers. Basically, because they knew that the news sub-editors who were appointed to read the news on two after that date, they would be able to do it, but perhaps not all the time. So they worked out a deal so that six music readers could come upstairs or come downstairs, I'm not sure where they are these days, and do them where the journalists couldn't. And I think that's what, if you listen now, you'll hear a mixture of the two. I have to say, the journalists are sounding good now. Blimmin' awful when they first started, but they're sounding good. But then again, so they should do, really. I mean, they understand what they're reading. If they don't, what hope have we for anybody else? It started some years ago, and the phrase there was street cred, I think, and it started with television announcers, and it annoyed a lot of people, I think. I remember sort of points of view touching on it a few times. You can kind of understand it, really. We're moving on, and it does sound, even when I listen to stuff that I did years ago, which is quite clipped, and I can't believe that I ever sounded like it. But you did. Not because you were aping anybody else, but because you felt that was where the bar for the standard was, you know?
88 to 91, Radio 2 FM from the BBC.
The 3 o'clock news, this is Colin Berry. Tony Blair has used his speech to the Scottish Labour Party conference.
I'm working for Three Counties Radio, BBC Three Counties Radio. I used to do a lot more, but because with BBC Local Radio, there's a lot of cutbacks and they have to use more of their staff people now. I was doing a weekly show, a regional show, going across six or seven stations at one time. But now I do programmes, tend to do them on high days and holidays, as they tend to say, and I come up with a few specialist type shows. One I come up with is Music Radio like it used to be, which is really what Radio 2 used to play, and it gets a good following, but nobody seems to take any notice of that. I get a lot of emails, and I do them whenever I can. Don't enjoy it so much now, because the technology is more important than what you're saying, I feel. Basically, because I'm not there every week. If I was there every week, it will become second nature to me, like it used to be at the old Luton studios when I was doing weekly shows. But there we are. You know, it's called progress. For some.
This is the BBC Light Programme.
I would like to have been able to pivot my years back and done a bit of the Light Programme. I would quite like to have done that, because the staff announcer really did come into his own there and did a lot of programme presenting, as well as reading the news. And I kind of like the old-fashioned way the Light Programme was. When did the rot set in? Well, I don't know, really. Probably the 90s. And think, when I say the rot, it's very much a personal thing. I didn't get quite so much out of it. I think towards the end of the 90s, people like me were not getting the bites of the cherry anymore. In other words, depping for programme presenters. The irony here is that the controller that took over was someone I worked for in television, doing Eurovision and Generation Game. He was a producer at the time, a guy called Jim Moyer. And I welcomed him when he got the job and dropped him an email, and we sort of chatted in the corridors. I thought, oh, that's going to be good for me. I had less programmes under that man than any other controller I've worked for in all my years at Radio 2, which is quite strange. He had this feeling that, you just wanted star names on the network, which he did with television, so that was the way the man was. But it meant that people like me became just newsreaders, really. Late night shows and early morning shows were really going to the freelancers, but it brought quite a bit of a problem for presentation department with more announcers than there were shifts to give. So at weekends you'd have reserve A, reserve B, reserve C, and I think we once had a reserve D, in order to make the books. Well, the books didn't balance because we're paying too many people, but it was years before they sorted that one out. You know what the BBC's like, suddenly we've got to do something about this, But no, I think from about 1996 onwards, it wasn't such a fun job anymore. When I say about making a difference, I like to, they play the hits, but I like to play the misses sometimes, In fact, I came up with this title for a programme with regards to the misses. And everyone says that I ought to do it. But, I mean, you've got to interest someone in it. I can't get people interested in that, you know. We should be playing the hits, said Francis Lyon when I said about this, with regards to the missus. No, we should be playing the hits. But if I do a programme and I play records that didn't quite get into the charts, I get email, oh, we haven't heard that for ages. How great. You know, I always get this. But management don't seem to take any notice of it. Or they wear blinkers and don't bother to look. But I think there is a market for a Radio 2 type show that we used to have years ago. There's too much overlap too, and magic and now you've got Smooth, little sub things on Smooth as well, and even the pop stations. I mean, they've got so many of those as well. I just feel somewhere in there there's room for a bit of Matt Munro and Jack Jones and Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet and all those voices that you still hear occasionally on Radio 2, but, you know, more often than not, you know, it's the one and a half, really one and a half pop music. I know that a lot of people would say, well, you know, there's not enough of an audience there. It's going to cost too much, but there's a great vacuum there. You know, so many stations, but no room for a light music station. Who plays Percy Faith in his orchestra anymore? You know, and Henry Mancini in his orchestra. Beautiful, beautiful tracks. Library full of them down the road from here. But nobody plays them anymore. Until they try it, they won't know how well it's received. It's no good saying, oh, we don't think it'll work. You know, it needs to be tried.